The Sunstone Foundation presents Addictive Aspects of Mormon Society, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
There you are. Find you. Are we going to need those doors open or closed? Hi, it's 4:30, and if you're ready, we're ready to start. You're at Sunstone. Is this working? Okay. No? I don't know which one works. Can you hear me yet? No. Who knows where to switch these things on? Oh, these are your mics. Does that help? Okay. Well, we're getting there. You're at the section on addictive aspects of Mormon society. I hope that's where you wanted to be because we're ready to present to you. The four of us all work in addictive processes and with clients with addictions. And I think to start off with, I'll introduce the panel to you. Then each one of us is going to take some time to give you an explanation of a particular aspect of addiction that we work with, following which we'll open the time up for questions and answers if you're interested in that. I'm Dr. Debbie Christensen, and I'll be the first presenter tonight. What I will be presenting on is an overview of Mormon culture and things about our culture that lead us into an addictive society. I work as a psychology resident at the Center for Counseling, Education, and Research, which is affiliated with Utah Valley Regional Medical Center, Orem Community Hospital, and American Fork Hospital. The part that I bring to the study on addiction is my work with compulsive eating as an addiction, and that's where my focus will be in the question and answer period. After I speak, Michael Barrett will speak on dysfunctional family dynamics that lead to addictive patterns in children. Mike has a PhD in counseling psychology from BYU, is affiliated with the Center for Change, and is the chief of psychology at the Utah Valley Regional Medical Center. After Mike, Harold Frost will speak, and he has a doctorate in counseling psychology from BYU also. He is the clinical coordinator for the eating disorders program and will speak on eating disorders as an addictive process and how that ties in with this particular culture. He is also affiliated with the Center for Change. The final speaker will be Dr. David Gardner, who has a PhD in marriage and family therapy. He's also affiliated with the Center for Change. He is the program director for outpatient child and adolescent psychological services at Utah Valley Regional Medical Center, and he will speak on the aspect of chemical dependency and how that is linked in with our culture and some of the dynamics that go on between the culture and those who suffer from chemical dependency. One of my goals for today that I wanted just to be upfront with you about is to increase compassion for those who do suffer from addictions, whatever form, and to increase our understanding of how we, as a group of people, feed into that addictive process and oftentimes make it worse for those who are suffering from addictions. And so that's where we're going to start from. First thing I felt like I needed to do was to define to you what we mean by addictions. And for that, I'm going to use a definition from Ann Wilson Schaaf, and this is what she says. An addiction is any process over which we are powerless. It takes control of us, causing us to do and think things that are inconsistent with our personal values and leading us to become progressively more compulsive and more obsessive. A sure sign of an addiction is the sudden need to deceive ourselves and others, to lie, deny, and cover up. An addiction is anything we feel tempted to lie about. Now, as we go on through the definition of addiction, there's one thing that the four of us feel quite strongly about and wanted to be clear on, and that is that an addiction is anything that you do to change or alter your present mood or how you're feeling. If you're down and you engage in something to get you up, that is likely an addiction at some part. Now, addictions can come in both substance addictions and process addictions. Substance addictions are addictions to alcohol, addictions to chemicals, and addictions to food. Process addictions are addictions to spending. That's people who spend so that they feel better. Gambling, sex, and eating as a process is also another form of an addiction which becomes a process addiction. The sure sign of an addiction is that you have the need to deceive yourself or the need to deceive other people, to appear to be other than or better than you really are, or to feel in control of a life that feels out of control. Now, in the addiction process, you start the addiction to gain a sense of control. Eventually, in that process, however, that addiction begins to control you, and you have no control over your addiction. Now, there are some aspects of Mormon society that we found contribute highly to the addictive process and those of us involved in this culture. And all of these aspects that I found that contribute to the addictive process are separate from, as I define the gospel, but are definitely a part of the culture. And the first thing, where the process begins, comes from a kind of thinking that I'll call hierarchical thinking. Elizabeth Dobson Gray, several years ago, wrote a book called Patriarchy as a Conceptual Trap. And in that book, she delineates the thinking called patriarchy and how that has led us progressively into a sicker society. Rather than use that term, I'm going to say hierarchical thinking, because I think that's exactly what she's talking about. And hierarchical thinking is what we do any time we look at two people or two groups of people and choose to rank the diversity that we see among those groups of people in any way. In any way that we rank diversity, we are engaged in hierarchical thinking. In Elizabeth Gray's book, her final statement is that we need to learn to honor diversity, that we should not rank diversity, since that is what is necessary for the maintenance in our system. But in our society, if we look very closely, we rank diversity continually. If you look at high council meetings and the competition that goes on between wards to prove which one is being a better ward, you're talking hierarchical thinking. If you think about sometimes the competition that our male members feel to hold particular priesthood offices and to feel that their value is determined by the level of priesthood office that they hold, you're talking hierarchical thinking. How many of us really believe that a visiting teacher is as important as a Relief Society president? To the extent that you don't believe that, you're involved in thinking hierarchies. I remember many years ago, the first time I was a Relief Society president, and I was quite young. I was 22 years old at the time, and I got involved in the way the church worked in this kind of hierarchical thinking. And I can remember month after month, I'd look at my statistics, and that was so important to me that they look right. That was more important to me, because that's how I measured my worth, than whether or not I was able to serve the women in the ward. In that extent, I was a part of that hierarchical thinking, and I was measuring my worth in terms of quantity, rather in terms of something much deeper and much more spiritual than that. Hierarchical thinking, how many of us determine our success by how many? How many attend meetings? How many hold temple recommends? How many pay tithing? All of those are forms of hierarchical thinking. All of those have very little to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because we are a society that is deeply embedded in this form of thinking, we also teach those of our members who are a part of our society that competition and scarcity is a part of life. By the scarcity model, and this is one that I found crucial in dealing with compulsive eating as an addiction. In the scarcity model, we believe that there is not enough to go around, and that in order to get our share of anything, we must compete to get it. And if someone else has something, that means we won't be able to have that same thing. And we create a competition among our society. And if you'll look at sometimes what happens when you've got an outgoing bishop, you'll notice that sense of competition among male priesthood leaders, that they must be competing to get the recognition that they need, and they probably deserve, but that they definitely need. And that sense of competition creates that sense of scarcity. Only one person will receive that. Now, if we look deeper into the gospel of Jesus Christ, the competition does not exist, because we've been told quite clearly that we are all equal, that we are one, that we are a part of the body of Christ, and that as a part of the body of Christ, not one member is more important than the other member. That's the gospel. But socially, we don't very often act in that manner, and we often act as if one member is very much more important than another member. I remember a talk Carolyn Pearson gave a few months ago where she talked about how interesting it was that in our church we teach that we honor motherhood above all others, and yet whenever you go to a church meeting or to general conference, you will notice that they will recognize the men on the stand and the leaders who are in attendance, and very seldom do they recognize the mothers. And that is an example of the hierarchy that we do socially buy into, although it's not a part of the gospel. With that scarcity model and that sense that there's not enough to go around, that we must be competing, we create a sense of fear and a need for control and a desire and a belief in perfectionism. And these become the root of addictive processes: the fear, the need to believe that you're in control, and the sense that you should or even could ever be perfect. The other day I was scanning through a bookstore and I saw an interesting chapter of a book that says we seek after perfection, but we seek after that perfection in worldly ways. How do we define perfection? And oftentimes the way we're seeking after that perfection goes back to our hierarchical model of thinking. It does not go back to Christ's perfection. The scriptures were told, "Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." Even as your Father in heaven is perfect means, to me, perfect in love. And that is the perfection we are seeking after. However, most members of our society are seeking after perfection as it's defined in a worldly sense: the perfect weight, the perfect control, the perfect look, the perfect bank balance, those kinds of perfections. That is not the perfection that I believe we should be seeking, but that is the perfection that we've been given. Because we're seeking after perfection, we've created a society of dishonest people. And that is what addicts basically are. Anybody who has an addiction is basically dishonest about what they're feeling. Oftentimes they become dishonest because they don't know what they're feeling. But originally the dishonesty was there to cover up who they really were, because the need to appear perfect was so important that it gave people very little room to experience what they really felt and express who they really were and to define the experiences that made them who they are. If you will attend Relief Society, this is to me the prime example of people who are appearing to look perfect. It is so seldom, and regrettably so seldom, that we in the church feel that it's okay to stand up and say, "I am really struggling with something." Even if it's a question about the gospel, that is not an appropriate place for us to stand up and do that. But rather we come to church to appear to be perfect and to share all of our answers and to appear that we've got it all together and we know exactly what's going on. Because of that need to appear perfect, we become confused about what's really going on inside of us. We become confused about our feelings because we need to look like we're in control. We've been told that there's something wrong with us if we're not the happiest people on earth. And so if we're depressed, we grin and bear it and smile and say, I'm just fine. All of these are the basis for addictions, because all of these form the basis for the need to cover up or hide your emotional state. And that's what an addiction does for you. We have been so dishonest about our feelings in public for so long that we no longer have the opportunity to learn from our mistakes. We are too busy covering up our mistakes to be able to honestly learn and grow from that which we are experiencing. We are too busy appearing to be perfect to actually learn what that perfection could possibly be. We've become a society of people where questioning is frightening, depression is frightening, hurt is frightening, anger is frightening. We understand none of our emotions, and when we feel those emotions, we have a need to cover them up and get away from them. One thing we know about people who suffer from obesity is that oftentimes they are very angry people deep inside, but they appear happy on the outside. They appear to be people who have no problems. They appear to be easy to get along with. And it takes a great deal of therapy to understand the anger that is embedded within them. But when they feel the anger, they turn to eating. And others, when they feel anger, turn to chemicals. And others, when they feel anger, turn to alcohol. And others, when they feel anger, turn to eating disorders. All of those processes come about because of what I've just defined, the hierarchical thinking, which leads to competition and scarcity in our thinking about this world, which leads to fear and a need to gain control, which leads to dishonesty and confusion, which becomes an addiction. And I'm going to turn the time over now to Michael Barrett, who's going to talk about dysfunctional family dynamics and how, in particular families, these same dynamics are enacted to create addictions.
I would like to focus my comments on family dynamics. I'm going to talk about families in general, and then towards the end of my paper, I'd like to talk a little bit about how specifically in our culture, the LDS culture, how things that we do, ways that we think, and part of what Debbie talked about, the hierarchical thinking, exacerbates those problems we have in our society. We live in a world with lots of changes. Some of you might be familiar with the work of Stephen Glenn about the changes that we have in our society and the impact that that's had on the family. Despite all the cries that we have about the changes and how they impact the family, that there's a need for a new emphasis in the family because the changes have been so rapid and so rampant and so deep in our society, that if we continue to do what we've done, we won't adequately need to meet the needs of our children. People seem to be ignoring that. There are some changes that we do see. People are more aware of the repression of women. People seem to be more aware of the need for fathering, and some people are trying to change those roles and to be flexible. But the changes don't seem to be that widespread as of yet. Some of the changes in society include the following. There's a lower family interaction. There's the high technology. There's a lower dependence on intergenerational communication in families. There's less time with families. There's less on-the-job training with families. There's less tasks where if you don't complete the task, it matters. You know, it means something. It's pretty hard. Maybe some of you can relate to asking your kids to clean their room, and if they don't clean their room, so what? I mean, there's no big consequence on the world if you don't clean your room. But there's lots of changes that we need to adapt to. We've come from a place where we used to spend maybe eight hours a day with our family to a place where we spend maybe, I think one study said that parents spend 14 minutes per day per child, and that 12 and a half of those minutes is one-way negative communication. Well, children are spending, you know, 5 to 7 hours with television. So I think it's time for us to learn. Matthew 5, verse 5, it says that the meek will inherit the earth. To me, that means people willing to learn, willing to look, take a different view, and possibly wake up a little bit. In the words of Eric Hoffer, in the times of change, learners inherit the earth. Well, the learned find themselves beautifully equipped to deal with a world that no longer exists. That's the call that we have in parenting, to not get trapped in dysfunctional family patterns. These changes in the society impact LDS as well as, you know, non-LDS families in our society. The changes are universal. There's a lot of controversy about statistics, differences between LDS and non-LDS. But one thing that's real consistent is that most of the dysfunctions are on the rise. You know, the unwanted teenage pregnancies, drug abuse, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, and family violence, sexual abuse. So what do our children need to not become statistics of abuse? What do we need to do to reduce the dysfunction of families in our culture? It's hard to put words on what children need. Words don't adequately describe it. When you come home from work and your child might grab onto your leg and hang on until you pick them up and hold them. Or with a note that was from a learning disabled child that says, this is a 7-year-old, "Dear Mrs. Jensen, I know I do bad work. Will you still like me? Even though I do bad work, love, Jenny." This is a 7-year-old girl already feeling some shame in her life and some of that false sense of badness that is a basis for addiction. Children need to be affirmed. They need to be loved. Low-risk kids for addiction are those who feel like they contribute. They feel like they're a part of things. They feel like they have an important role in the family. They have a sense of personal power. They have a sense of that what they do does make a difference. What I'd like to talk a little bit about I reviewed a few sources on functional families and what some of the commonalities are. Functional families guard against addiction. A couple of the sources I looked at were a book on effective LDS families by Dyer and Coons, John Bradshaw's work on healthy families, and Kim Lamson's work on eating disorder versus non-eating disorder families. There were a couple themes notable in functional families. Let me tell you what they are. Number one, clear, direct, and honest, and abundant communication. Number two, a value of work ethic and accountability for the work. Number three, emotional intimacy, including a show of affection. Number four, consistency in limit setting and emotional availability to the child. Number five, expression of emotion is encouraged, including sadness, anger, grief, irritability, anxiety, any other difficult or painful emotion. Problems are acknowledged, accepted, and resolved, not hidden or ignored. Number seven, mistakes are forgiven and viewed as learning tools rather than evidence of, quote, some kind of badness or flaw. In contrast to the functional family, the dysfunctional family is a breeding ground for addictions and for other forms of emotional illness, mental illness, and other kinds of problems related. Hierarchical thought fuels the patterns and the rules of the obsessive-compulsive family. So let's look at some of the rules of the dysfunctional family. These are given by Fossum and Mason. Number one is to be in control, that you always have to be in control at every given moment as a parent. Number two, perfectionism. You have to be right no matter what the cost is. Any cost, you'll be right. Number three, blame. If things don't go the way they're supposed to go, then make sure you blame somebody. That will take care of the problem right there. It seems to make people feel better in that moment. Denial. Deny your feelings, especially any negative ones. Unreliability. Anyone knows that consistency takes too much work and effort and sacrifice. It's pretty tough. Number six, incompleteness. Whatever you do, do not bring things to completeness. Do not put closure or resolution on anything. Number seven, no talking. Don't talk openly and honestly, especially about any family secrets, any family problems, any shameful things, abusive things, or any obsessive problems that anyone in the family might have. So it's through these dysfunctional family rules that shame and confusion is breeded in children, which is a core and a basis for addiction. The shame comes mainly from abandonment from parents. In John Bradshaw's book on the family, he delineates rather well many ways that we abandon our children. You know, we can physically abandon them. That could be the child feels physically abandoned, whether he's sitting in a rest area like we heard on the news a little while ago, while the parents were in another state where he was totally physically abandoned, or a small child might feel abandoned if a parent has been working for 5 days in a row and never seen them. They don't have the cognitive skills to tell the difference, but they do feel the abandonment. By not modeling their emotions to their children, by not being there to affirm the child's emotion, by physically, sexually, emotionally, or spiritually abusing a child, by using the child to take care of their unmet dependency needs, by hiding and lying and being secretive about their own problems, by not giving children their time, their direction, their attention, and by parents acting shameless, in other words, perfect, I don't do anything wrong, which fits into part of what Debbie talked about the need to have an image in the hierarchical structure of our culture. So how do we get from shame to addiction? Out of this abandonment that children feel comes addiction. With the child's view of parents as being all-knowing, all-good, perfect, children deify their parents because to do otherwise would be too scary. How could you possibly believe that your mom or dad could protect you from this awful, horrible, scary world with monsters and rapists and boogermans and all those other things unless they were perfect? So the child, any incongruence that they feel, they blame it on themselves and start to question who they are and whether they're okay and whether they think right or whether they feel right. And out of that comes a false self, a false image that they have to promote to protect themselves, that they're okay, that they're strong, that they're perfect, that they're doing everything right. And after years and years of promoting a false image to protect oneself, one gets so out of touch with who they really are that they do really become lost. That confusion, that loneliness, the numbness, and that emptiness fuels obsessive-compulsive habits, obsessive thought, and addictions. Because the person feels empty, and there's always this driving need to fill that emptiness. But that emptiness is like a bottomless pail where you have to have more and more and more and more. And in an addiction, it's more and more food or more alcohol or more drugs or more TV or more work or more sex or whatever the addiction is. And it seems to soothe for that moment, well, there's more, and then it goes away. So what do we do in the LDS culture to exacerbate this damaging, dysfunctional family processes? Number one, we set up inequality in relationships. The patriarchal model or priesthood concept can be distorted and twisted and into validating a concept that's been going on for ages, and that is that children should be silent. They should be seen and not heard. They should shut up, and obedience is the prime source of goodness. If you're obedient, you're a good kid. Sometimes priesthood is used to validate that distorted idea. Doctrine and Covenants, section 121, verses 39 to 42, gives a little more real view of what it's all about. We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. Debbie talked a little bit about that in the hierarchical thinking. Here many are called, but few are chosen. No power or influence can or ought be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness, meekness, and love unfeigned, by kindness and pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul, and out of hypocrisy, without hypocrisy, and without any guile. One thing that we can do is to try not to get into that distorted idea about what authority is, no matter what authority we have, whether it's motherhood or fatherhood or priesthood or whatever the hood is. Number two, mistakes, sometimes we feel like they need to be punished rather than forgiven. I think my model about forgiveness is the story of Christ at the well, where the woman who was promiscuous came and the people were going to stone her with stones, and his comment to her was, "Go thy way and sin no more." And his comment to the other folks was, "He who is without sin, throw the first stone." We don't spend enough time asking our children, "What did you learn? How did it feel? What does it mean to you? What are you going to do next time? How do you think you'll handle this again? Would you like to make this same mistake twice?" Sometimes it's easier to put punishment on, because the other way I just talked about takes work and effort and energy. Number three, image orientation. Focus on externals, achievements, positions, places in hierarchies. You hear this all the time. Are you, you know, questions like, "Are you an Eagle Scout?" I mean, how many times do you hear people say, "Are you a Tenderfoot Scout?" Hey, all right, you know. Or, I mean, I don't hear that a lot. I don't know about you guys. Instead of, "What is your calling?" People ask, "What is your calling?" Instead of, maybe, "How does it feel to serve in your calling, whatever it is?" Number four, focusing on the future instead of the now, the outcome versus the process. Typified in, I think, it's a pretty neat song in Sunday school, "Someday I'll Be a Missionary," whatever it is. I think you know that song. But how much time spend on what are you right now? Someday I'll do this and I'll do that and I'll do this and that, but what about now? What about where you're at now? Isn't that okay? Someday you'll be baptized. Someday you'll be a missionary. Someday you'll be a deacon. Someday you'll be a temple bride. Someday a stake president. And maybe then you'll be somebody, often is the inference that people take. Number five, the concept that this is the only true church becomes an image rather than a concept of maybe we have something to offer. And this fuels rigidity, black and white thinking, perfectionism, obsessive compulsivism. Comments we hear in the hospital a lot when people come to the ER, like, "I want to see an LDS physician. Has to be an LDS physician." As if that really matters. And number six, irresponsible attitudes about family planning. We all know that LDS folks have larger families than a lot of people in other cultures, in many other cultures anyway. People talk a little bit of loss of identity and birth order processes. People talk about concern for the physical health of the mother, emotional health. But how many people spend time talking about the emotional health of the child? Is a person willing to give up some workaholism or TV-aholism or whatever the ism is so that they can take care of 8 or 10 children without their children growing up in abandonment and shame? Family size is not the issue, but commitment. We can't utilize our membership in the church, our knowledge or feelings of truth, if we ourselves aren't healthy and centered, if we're on an outside focus. We in this room can get focused on diplomas and positions and reputations and incomes. And intellectualization and completed tasks or other sources of validation, including colleague or peer adulation. The change in this cycle of shame and confusion leading to addiction from a hierarchical lifestyle needs to begin within each of one of us.
My part of the panel will be dedicated to talking about eating disorders as an addictive process. And for some of you, that may seem a little strange because typically when we talk about addictive processes, the first thing that comes to our mind is someone strung out on drugs or some wino slumped over as a result of a drunk. But I would like to assert to you that eating disorders are, in fact, an addictive process. However, any discussion as to whether eating disorders are an addictive process or not must be preceded by a definition of what eating disorders are. And when I refer to eating disorders this afternoon, I will be referring to either anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, or compulsive eating. And when a young lady, and I would like to emphasize the word lady because 90 to 95% of all eating disorder victims are female, and I think as I go on you'll come to understand why. When a young lady is engaging in anorexia nervosa, basically what she's not doing is eating. She may be engaging in some incredible behaviors like ingesting only 250 calories a day and running 10 to 15 miles, all in an effort to rid her body of fat. She will have lost at least 15% of her body weight and will experience amenorrhea, that she will lose her monthly cycle. She will also experience distortions in her body image. Recently, we received an anorexic young lady from California. She was 5'8" and she weighed 60 pounds, and the only thing that she wanted to talk about was losing a few more pounds so she could look good. To us, she looked like someone from Dachau, but to her, she still saw herself as fat. Victims of bulimia nervosa ingest large amounts of food in a discrete period of time and usually follow that ingestion of food with some kind of purging. The purging takes on many different forms. The most typical kind that you hear about is vomiting. I've had clients who vomit as many as 40 times a day, if you can believe that. Another form of vomiting is laxative abuse. At one point in time, I had a client that was ingesting over 200 laxatives a day. Her whole day consisted of roaming from grocery store to grocery store, buying and stealing X-Lax and candy bars. At one point in time, she had eaten so much food and the laxatives didn't work, she showed up in the emergency room looking like a pregnant lady. Compulsive eating is very similar to bulimia in that victims eat a large amount of food in a discrete period of time. And I think the main difference between compulsive eating and bulimia is that the victims are usually obese and do not engage in radical forms of purging such as vomiting and laxative abuse. Instead, they try to purge themselves by going on various crash diets. Now, Dr. Christensen has given us a definition of addiction as a pathological relationship with a mood-altering substance, situation, or event. And I would like to further elaborate on this definition by giving you Steele's criteria for addiction. Steele, who is a psychologist, sets forth the following characteristics of an addictive process. And I would like to go through these criteria, then come back and see how eating disorder victims fit in this. Number one, it eradicates awareness of what is hurting or troubling the person. Number two, it hurts other involvements. The person then turns increasingly towards the experience as his one source of gratification in life. Number three, it lowers self-esteem. Number four, it is not pleasurable. There's nothing pleasurable about the addiction cycle. What is pleasurable about addiction is the absence of feelings and thoughts that lead to pain. Number five, it is predictable, providing a sureness of effect. Let's see how eating disorders fit into these criteria. Number one, it eradicates awareness. At one time at the BYU Comprehensive Clinic, I videotaped one of my clients binging and vomiting. It was a very interesting process to watch. And after she was done purging, she immediately went to the bathroom to clean herself up. And during that time, I rewound the tape so when she came out, the tape would be ready to play. As soon as she came out, I played the videotape for her, and she seemed to be incredulous. As she watched the tape, she says, "I don't remember eating that fast. I don't remember eating that much food." And it became quite obvious to me that what was happening is that she was experiencing a dissociative type process. As a matter of fact, when I ask my eating disorder victims what their eating disorder does for them, the most frequent word that I get back is the word numb. My eating disorder numbs me. And one might ask the question, well, what kind of pain are these people trying to avoid? And I would submit to you that you would have to look at each case individually. But at Utah Valley, one of the startling statistics that we're coming up with is that 70 to 80% of our eating disorder victims are victims of sexual abuse. Root and Fallon state that eating disorder sufferers come to therapy looking like a victim. Her defenses, relationships, verbal and nonverbal behavior, history and affect are strikingly similar to those associated with physical victimization. She has low self-esteem, appears powerless in relationships, has substance abuse problems, and is depressed. Their coping style may include disassociation of herself from her body, minimization of her difficulties, repression of painful material, gaps in memory, denial of problems, and foggy recollections of childhood. She has difficulty labeling feelings and recognizing her anger. She may report a fear of intimacy or a fear of abandonment. Number two, it hurts other involvements. I'm aware of an eating disorder victim who was making $40,000 a year but had to declare bankruptcy because she couldn't afford her $100-a-day food habit. Both Dr. Barrett and I worked with one patient who became bulimic at the age of 16, got married at the age of 18, and the bulimia completely destroyed her marriage. At that point in time, her husband left her with two children, and she was so entrenched in this cycle that she gave up her two children to adoption, because now it was more important to binge and vomit and to be skinny than it was to be responsible to those children. Number three, it lowers self-esteem. I think that's obvious. Number four, it is not pleasurable. Going back to this videotape, this young lady used Ipecac to purge herself. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with Ipecac, but that's kind of an awful drug. And she must have suffered for about 40 to 50 minutes before she finally started vomiting, and she retched about 7 or 8 times. It did not look like a fun process to me. Number five, it is predictable. And to me, this is what keeps eating disorder people entrenched in their behaviors. What becomes scary after a while is life itself. You know, what becomes scary is going out to a dance, going out and socializing. What becomes safe is their eating disorder, the cycle of binging and vomiting or starvation or whatever their cycle may be. And it kind of reminds me of the allegedly true story from ancient Arabia. When someone committed a capital crime, they would bring them into this room. And they would say, you have your choice of death. If you choose door A, then it's death by beheading. And if you choose door B, then it's death by hanging. And I'm sorry, we just don't talk about door C. And invariably, people would choose door A or door B, and no one would ever choose door C. And interestingly enough, door C was a door to the streets, but no one ever chose that because it was unknown. At this time, I would like to quote from James Michener. And he says, life is the journey that men take to find themselves. If they fail in this, it doesn't much matter what else they find. Money, position, fame, many loves, revenge are all of little consequence. And when the tickets are collected at the end of the ride, they are tossed into the bin marked failure. But if a man happens to find himself, if he knows what he can depend upon to do, the limits of his courage, the position which he will no longer retreat, that is his boundaries, the degree to which he can surrender his inner life to a spouse, the secret reservoir of his determination, the extent of his dedication, the depths of his feeling for beauty, for honesty, then he has found the mansion which he can inhabit with dignity all the days of his life. Develop to the limits of our abilities. However, in the case of addiction, our life energies are not given to growth and development, but instead are used up in just surviving. Dr. Barrett has helped us explore this can push people off the path of growth and development. And in regards to looking at women's issues, feminist therapy asks us not only to look at the family environment, but to look at the cultural milieu as well. And to get into the social-cultural perspective of eating disorders, I would like to quote from Ambrose Bierce. And I would like you, women in the audience this evening, to ask yourself how you feel about this quote. And Ambrose says, "To men, a man is but a mind. Who cares what face he carries or what form he wears? But a woman's body is the woman." Let me read that one more time. To men, a man is but a mind. Who cares what face he carries or what form he wears? But a woman's body is the woman. As you might expect, I talk to a lot of women's groups and speak to a lot of relief societies, and it's interesting the reaction I get to that statement. The most typical reaction is, that's a true statement. You know, no one ever challenges that. But as a psychologist, I am trained to look at some of the assumptions that we have. In the book, A Woman's Way of Knowing, they point out the fact that it was only 100 years ago that women were discouraged from going to college because it was feared that their ovaries would atrophy. Okay? You know, no one wants to go to college and end up with atrophied ovaries. But if, you know, and I would assume that 100 years ago, sad to say, some women may have not gone to college because they bought onto that. And so women in today's society have to be very careful about some of the assumptions that are given forth. Fortunately, women are becoming more cognizant. Let me read a journal entry from a recovered bulimic by the name of Jane. She writes, I've come to realize that I am but a microcosm of a world of women existing in a despair that rips off our power. Most women do not know their full power. They accept themselves at 50% or 20% or less of what they really could be. Where does this energy of these women go? Look at the women's magazines. That is where the energy is going. Women are programmed to be concerned with external glamour. Beauty is one thing, glamour is another. Beauty comes from externalizing inner power. Glamour comes from our need to pretend we are beautiful, a compensation for our own inner fears and weaknesses. But true power comes from within. It is a state of consciousness that commands respect regardless of our looks. A woman who knows she is powerful does not need to prove it. Glamour thrives on despair. When we are feeling desperate about ourselves, we need to make ourselves feel young, pretty, and worthwhile. But when we find real power, we will be creating a world that we love, becoming who we want to become, fulfilling the visions that we possess, and that beauty will shine through every action we do and every word that we say. Unfortunately, Mormon society a lot of times embraces our general society's concept of womanhood. I remember my very first bulimic client went in and felt the need to confess her eating disorder to her bishop. And she confessed the fact, binging and vomiting 7 times a day, and I guess the bishop got really confused and was trying to comfort her in some way, and he said, well, I'd rather have you throwing up now and then than be fat like some of these other sisters. That set me back about 5 weeks in therapy. I like to endorse some of the things that are happening in our society today. For example, the Mormon Women's Forum. They are questioning some of the assumptions that are going on in our society. For example, take some simple things like the fact that a non-member male can stand in a circle to bless their newborn child, but a member female cannot. And here again, one must ask, what is being communicated? Or what is being communicated by the fact, a simple fact, that young male priesthood holders can pass around the microphones on fast and testimony meeting? I mean, these are simplistic type things, but the question must be asked, you know, what does that communicate? I'm sorry I don't have any statistics to quote you on how the Mormon society does compared to the rest of the society in regards to eating disorders. However, Kim Lampson, a psychologist up in Washington State, has done a study that suggests conservative religions do have a higher incidence of eating disorders than other religions. I know that there was a study done at BYU that showed that the incident rates at Brigham Young University were slightly higher than the national norms. And the national norms suggest that women college age, about 20% of them engage in some kind of eating disorders. I would like to conclude my remarks by saying that eating disorder victims, like most people, have hopes and dreams. They seek out love, success, and happiness. However, in their effort to find these things, they have embraced an impoverished map of the world. Instead of leading them to the highways and byways of success and happiness, their impoverished map of the world has led them to the swamps of self-contempt, self-disparagement, and sometimes to the quicksand of death itself. Nevertheless, with the right kind of help, love, and encouragement, and most of all patience, the eating disorder victim can be led back to a realization of things as they really are. And with the realization of things as they really are, they will come to a knowledge that life is more than having your feet on the scale and your head in the toilet. Thank you.
I'm Dave Gardner. I'm going to be talking about LDS aspects of addiction with regard to chemical dependency. This is the most I've ever written out a talk in about the last 5 years. I told Debbie I'm not sure I'm going to be able to function, you know, going off of a written script here. About 4 years ago in therapy, I was involved with a 35-year-old first counselor in an LDS bishopric who came in to see me for therapy and told me that he was using approximately $600 to $900 a week of cocaine. After a couple of sessions, as we got into the aspects of his addiction and determined that he was in the right place to get therapy, I suggested that he return and talk to his bishop to begin to establish a positive support group and a system that could help him with his recovery. He came back the next week to our session and said, yes, he had talked to his bishop, and that his bishop said, well, it's not like you've broken the word of wisdom or anything. Okay? Honest engine. Now, this example in and of itself is just full of illustrations of the dilemmas that are found in dealing with chemical addictions in the LDS culture. Let me begin by saying there are lots and lots of issues that could be addressed. The ones I'm going to point out and discuss very briefly are some general ponderings that I've had as I've prepared this presentation. Families in the LDS culture are no more likely to be affected by chemical abuse, and I certainly include alcohol abuse. When I talk about chemicals, I use all of that interchangeably. They're no more likely to be involved in chemical or substance abuse than our families in the rest of society, where societies have a high standard and of norms and behaviors. However, when substance abuse does affect LDS families, it tends to be much more traumatic and much more debilitating. And it has to do with all of the hierarchical thinking that we've been talking about in the joint and the joint definition of addiction that we've been presenting so far this evening. Other families, it seems, are able to join in the recovery process, where conversely the LDS family tends to shun and leave the identified patient alone, feeling that somehow that their substance abuse is going to wear off, or if I get involved in helping you recover from a substance abuse, that there's somehow that's going to affect me. The fact that we believe that man will be punished for his own sins and not for anybody else's transgression seems to have taken an awkward twist in the LDS family, in that they are likely to avoid culpability in terms of accepting roles in the dysfunctional family system or as codependents with anyone affected with a specific chemical dependency. In the Doctrine and Covenants in Section 89, of course, we refer to this as the word of wisdom, and we find counsel about living, which if followed, will give us strength and great blessings. Unfortunately, this passage of Scripture has become the standard by which many in the church not only judge one's worthiness, but often the worth of a person themselves. It says in verse 3 in that section that it is, quote, adapted to the capacity of the weak and the weakest of all the saints who are or can be called saints. By these words, our culture has come to view the use of prohibitive substances as the bottom line in terms of personal worthiness. Now, that in and of itself creates that hierarchical thing that Dr. Christensen was talking about and creates that perfectionism and some of the craziness in terms of the dysfunctions that Mike was discussing. I mean, all of you probably know stories. My own family is full of stories about kids who have talked about the evils of the word of wisdom. My own mother related an incident when, as a young boy of 3 or 4, I saw a man smoking. And I reportedly said to Mom, "Mommy, Heavenly Father doesn't love that man because he's smoking, does he?" Well, in 1986, we were in Seattle, Washington, on our way to the Expo in Vancouver, and my family, walking down a sidewalk early in the morning, ran across an inebriated man laying there in the gutter who rose up and asked me for a light for his cigarette. Well, my 4-year-old daughter turned around to that guy and said, "You shouldn't smoke, mister. That makes your lungs black." Now, 35 years later, you know, the teachings are the same, but obviously my daughter got more of the point than I ever did. You know, so I'm pleased that there's some progress being made in some circles anyway. 2 years ago, a friend of mine who teaches seminary here in the Salt Lake Valley asked his senior seminary students to list sins in order of gravity. I found the results rather startling. Number one on the list was smoking and drinking. Number two on the list was stealing. Number three on the list was not going to church. Number four on the list was sex before marriage. And number five on the list was murder. Someplace along the way, they seem to have missed the point. The fact that the order is so confused speaks again to that twisted hierarchical thinking. The Lord said, "I, the Lord, cannot look upon sin with the least degree of allowance." He didn't go on and say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You know, this is the order of allowance that I will not allow. He just said, "I won't look at it." In other holy writ, we've been told that blaspheming against the Holy Ghost and murder and sexual transgressions rank up there pretty high. But it's that it takes us away from the holiness and communion with what we perceive to be a heavenly being, not the fact that those specific things were done. Anyway, the drive for perfection rarely allows one in the LDS culture who has used chemicals as a way to cope with perceived pain or to gain some illusion of control to openly admit and to freely acknowledge their powerlessness over that substance that holds them hostage. This indeed is the first step to recovery, to admit our powerlessness over that thing that holds us hostage. Denial in the LDS culture becomes more deep and debilitating. Recovery is more difficult within the LDS framework because often the 12-step groups and other support mechanisms are perceived as not being in line with gospel principles. Our self-righteous reliance on self-reliance also contributes to our inability to reach out for assistance when it's truly needed. Patterns of addiction in the LDS culture tend to be more damaging than the national norms. This is particularly borne out if you look at alcohol abuse in Utah adolescents. What we find is that adolescents in Utah drink more than the national average. I mean, individually, not as a group, but the individuals tend to drink more. They tend to drink more frequently. They tend to drink alone in solitude. They tend to drink to get drunk rather than to enhance some kind of social interaction. They also tend to drink more straight alcohol than they do mixed drinks. It's only in Utah that you'll find adolescents bragging that they went to a party where they drank straight Everclear. You know, Everclear is a 190-proof straight grain alcohol, which has on it three different distinct warnings that it's not for human consumption, and yet is available in every state liquor store in the state of Utah. But no place else will you find kids bragging that they chugged a half pint of Everclear. You find that in the state of Utah. You find these kids drinking by themselves, drinking way, way, way to excess. And the pattern is just different. And part of it stems from that notion, that twisted hierarchical thinking, that the word of wisdom and breaking the word of wisdom and using those substances is such a grievous thing. Okay? And so they can't do it with groups because then they have witnesses. And they drink to get drunk so that... I'll get into that in a minute. See? I told you I can't do this well. Okay. There was a major jump in the state of Utah in drug use between the 7th and the 8th grade. It goes in a report, the latest statistics we have is from a book called Utah, The Demographic Perspective by Tom Martin, Tim Heaton, and Steve Barr out of BYU. In there it shows that from 7th to 8th grade, it jumps in Utah from a reported 26% of kids in the 7th grade have experimented with some type of substance or alcohol. It jumps between 7th and 8th grade to 36%. It then again jumps from 8th to 9th grade. It goes from 36% to 45%. So we're talking in 2 years, a 19% increase in reported drug use. Now, if you look at all the other ages spread out across the demographics, you find that those are the highest increase in substance and alcohol abuse. Now, part of that is developmental in nature. Kids, when they begin about 12 to 14 years old, begin to develop a sense of who they are. They develop a sense of identity. They develop a sense of personality. They are trying on. I mean, that's their definition as an adolescent, is to try on the norms and the expectations of the previous generation and to determine what they're going to carry on and what they're not going to. In the LDS Church, the age at which more kids drop out than any other is 14 years of age. It wasn't any big mistake that Joseph Smith was pondering religion at the age of 14. And that wasn't something that was picked out of the hat. That's the age at which the majority of kids make decisions, especially in the LDS culture, with regard to temple marriage, with regard to substance abuse, with regard to going on missions, or they tend to drop out. It's that sense of personality, that sense of identity that they're striving to accomplish. And that is why peer groups become such an important part of their life at that point. Family of origin drops out of focus for them, and the peer group becomes the primary focal point for adolescents at that age. When we see that huge increase, they perceive pain that they are trying to cope with, and they find the easiest way to deal with it is to pop a pill or smoke a joint or do some type of mind-altering substance. The earlier kids start, the more likely it is that they're going to be addicted. If you started drinking, or if someone, not you, but if someone started drinking before the age of 21, their chances of becoming an alcoholic or substance abusing dependent addicted person increased by 80%, just by the mere fact that they waited until they're 21 years old. Well, those facts have their foundation in some physiological things about chemical changes in the brain that happen at maturity. But anyway, see, I digressed again. Anyway, last year I was sitting in a what do they call those things? No, priesthood, what's it called? No, that's not it either. When the guys come and tell you what you're supposed to be doing. Leadership meeting, that was it. It was a Melchizedek Priesthood Leadership Meeting. And I was in this meeting, and Robert Taylor, the first Quorum of 70, came, and he was talking to us about peer influence on kids, okay? And the church did a study a couple of years ago in which they found that what they were specifically looking at was whether or not positive peer influence had as much influence on kids as negative peer pressure, okay? And what they found, they studied some Aaronic priesthood quorums, and they found that positive peer pressure didn't make one bit of difference. Didn't make kids more committed, didn't help them obey more, didn't do anything for them. But negative peer pressure made a whole lot of difference. If they had somebody in that Aaronic priesthood quorum that was messing up, they tend to pull more kids away than if the whole quorum was keeping together. It didn't keep them all invested, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. Sadly, it's at this time when parents label that adolescent as, you know, the emerging monster and pull away from those kids, when what they need, as Dr. Barrett said, is that consistency and that continuity. They need to be able to know that mom and dad are there. And yet parents pull away, they restrict their love, they make fun of, they take advantage, it goes on and on. Okay, in Utah, approximately 10% of the adult population drink. About 20% of the adult population use some type of substance, okay? Now, we only have 10% of the population drinking, but we rank 6th in the United States in terms of alcohol consumption. Okay, what does that one tell you? That the people who drink in Utah really drink in Utah, okay? That comes from Bruce Woolley, by the way, at the BYU McDonald Health Center, is the one that told me about that one. I was really surprised. Those who are chemically addicted tend to look to their addiction for one of two antithetical things, okay? One is that they turn to their chemical to escape their feelings. That is, that their feelings are so intense, whatever they may be, that they are looking to escape their feeling. As John Bradshaw said, that Harold alluded to, they are looking for a psychic numbing so that they can escape those feelings, and they don't want to deal with it anymore. The other one at the opposite end of the continuum is that they are so emotionally labile all the time that they are looking for something to stimulate their emotions and stimulate their feelings. Okay? So people tend to be chemically addicted for one of those two reasons, and they use their addiction for that. We all know people or know stories of people who have been typically withdrawn and quiet who after a few drinks will invariably become the life of the party. And conversely, we know people who are normally open and gregarious and happy who after a few drinks become morose and sullen and suicidal. Different chemicals work differently on different people. I mean, certainly in general categories, you can say this is an upper and this is a downer and this is something else over here. But every chemical has a different effect on different people. People begin to use drugs for social recreational reasons, to be accepted or to be part of the in crowd. Drug use quickly becomes obsessive and compulsive in nature. And we see that people don't see the line. They lose track, and that's part of the obsessive nature of chemical dependency and drug use. That very quickly they cross this and they spend more money and more time involved in the drug and in their drug culture. They think about the drug more. If you know people who are into drugs, check this out, because they spend more time and money investing in obtaining the drug. They think their talk is always about where to get the substance. It's about the last party they went to. It's about the next party they are going to. It's about who's got the best stuff around right now. It's about where can I score? It's about, did you hear about so-and-so got busted? Did you hear that such-and-such is going to get raided? Did you hear that, I mean, it's about the problems I'm having because of my substance abuse, and it inevitably turns to, one of these days I'm going to get out of this junk. Okay, one of the local drug experts in Salt Lake Valley is Dr. Michael DeCaria. I was going to describe this, but I'm going to draw it out real fast. He talks about drug abuse and drug use in terms of a 2x2 matrix that he does like this. He talks about this is the social recreational side of drug use. This is the obsessive compulsive side of drug use. He says these are socially acceptable drugs in this quadrant, and these are socially unacceptable drugs, which is really a sad commentary in and of itself. In this one, Mike lists alcohol, marijuana, and cocaine. Down here is listed all barbiturates, speed in its various forms, heroin. Okay? And what he says is that the majority of people start out using these socially acceptable drugs for social recreational reasons. And they look at themselves and they say, hey, I'm holding down a job. I'm doing very, very well. I'm even holding down church callings. They can justify their value behavior discrepancy without a whole lot of difficulty. But as you've already heard, that lie is part of the addictive process, lying to themselves and deceiving themselves. You know, their relationships are fine. I've got a patient that I've been seeing for about 4 years. His only real problem is that he uses heroin about twice a year. Okay? His family is very, very well known in the hierarchy of the church. This guy, this is what he does. He takes his ZCMI credit card. He goes over and he buys about 7 or 8 color TVs at ZCMI's. He takes those TVs and then goes down to a local pawn shop. In the boxes, brand new, straight from the shipping dock, he takes them down and turns them into cash. He then comes up here to Salt Lake to one of the shooting galleries around. He buys heroin. He sits and chips at heroin all weekend long, takes what heroin he has left, sells it to the other junkies around, goes back to the pawn shop, collects his TVs, takes them back to ZCMI and says, take these off my charge card. I decided I don't want them. Pretty clever, huh? He thought this sucker out really, really well. But he does this about twice a year. Is he a heroin addict? Absolutely. You bet he is. It's not that he's out there shooting up and booting that drug every day or every weekend, but he has a compulsive pattern that he goes through. Now, these people down here are really easy to get into treatment who are using these socially unacceptable drugs for obsessive-compulsive reasons because they hurt. They're in physical pain. And they want treatment, and they want it now. These people are impossible to get into treatment because there's nothing in their life that shows them that their addiction is creating a problem. And very quickly they cross this line, but they don't see it. They don't get that they are being obsessive and compulsive. What they get is that, yeah, I'm having problems, but that's because of the other jerk. And they start blaming and they start projecting and they start defending themselves, and they're caught in that denial. Okay, I'm running out of time, huh? I knew it. See, I knew I shouldn't have written this stuff down. Okay, I want to go through a couple of things real quickly. Bill Glasser in San Francisco, who developed reality therapy, has a concept that I think addresses a lot of issues very, very well. He talks about positive and negative addictions. He describes the process wherein people are seeking a release from what they perceive to be pain, and they go through higher and higher highs necessary because of the tolerance involved in substance abuse, and they find lower and lower lows, but they come more frequently and they become deeper and deeper until people basically implode upon themselves. The numbing cycle becomes more obsessive and compulsive and therefore increasingly addictive. Again, from this book by Barr, Heaton, and Martin, A Democratic Perspective, the following is found. This was a study done in 1984 among high school seniors. Okay, alcohol. The national percentage was 92.6% of high school seniors had ever used alcohol across the nation. In Utah, 55.8%. Okay, we're about half the national average. Cigarettes, 69.7% nationally. In Utah, 44.2%. Marijuana, 54.9%. In Utah, 33.6%. Now notice, those are the big three that are associated with the word of wisdom kinds of things. All right. Now we shift gears. Heroin. The national average for heroin use among high school seniors is 1.3%. It's 1.4%. All right? LSD and psychedelics, including mushrooms and all that good kind of stuff. Nationally, the average comes out to 8%. In Utah, 10.5%. Pain medications wasn't even listed on the national studies, on the national numbers, but 19.6% of high school seniors regularly abuse pain medications. Okay? One of the startling things that we're finding is the increasing abuse of prescription medication. And I would submit that we're seeing that because having a script from a licensed medical professional certainly legitimizes my use of this pill. And I can legitimize it because I have a piece of paper that says it's okay, which ties into some of those crazy dynamics and hierarchical thinking that we've been talking about. The addiction is just as bad, and we're seeing it worse and worse. For those of you who are looking to get into a field that's going to be up and coming, you look at geriatrics or you look at addiction of pain medications in the state of Utah, because we're going to see it more and more. Substance abuse of pain meds in Utah is an increasingly difficult problem. Another thing is our denial. Nowhere else in the world will you find non-alcoholic wines, will you find no nicotine cigarettes. Okay, I'm talking about cloves and other like those. Will you find people who so strongly want to be in the world, I mean of the world, while they're still being in the world. We develop this, we strive somehow to not avoid evil, but to look like we're having fun. There seems to be an attitude that living the gospel is an infringement by God upon our rights, that the gospel was placed here as some kind of stumbling block to our own personal indulgence. The addictive aspects of this society foster the kinds of problems that we've been discussing, and until we as a people come to grips with our codependence with one another, we are doomed to repeat the problem for more generations to come. Forums like this are the beginning, but within discussions outside of this room, the real issues with real people and real problems begin to be dealt with. Thank you.
We have a few minutes left for questions. Does anybody have questions? Go ahead. I'll repeat them over the microphone, and then if you pass it around. Okay.
Is there any evidence to support the notion that alcohol abuse or substance abuse is related to factors of heredity?
Okay. The question was, is there evidence to support the notion that there are hereditary factors in substance abuse?
Yes, definitely. I don't know. If you look in John Bradshaw's book On the Family, as well as his book on Healing the Shame That Binds You, and look in the bibliography, you'll find specific you'll find specific documentation of that. But yeah, we find over and over and over again transgenerational processes of alcohol. Now, there's a big question about whether that's environmental and it's a learned process, or whether it's indeed a heredity gene link kind of trait. The studies that tend to bear out that it is indeed a genetically linked inheritance are in the twin studies that have been done at St. Louis George Washington Medical School, where they took twins at birth and separated them and followed up later, and they found the same preponderance of, a higher preponderance of alcohol and substance abuse in twins that have been separated than in other siblings that have been raised together.
One statistic that's commonly cited is that the person who drinks has a 1 in 10 chance of being alcoholic. For people from alcoholic families, the chances go to 1 to 4 instead of 1 to 10. I don't have a reference on it. That's commonly cited in the substance abuse field.
Okay, go ahead.
I take exception to your use of the word hierarchy. I think it's a perfectly respectable concept, but I think some people misuse it. Some people use guns to kill people. We couldn't function without hierarchical distinctions. But if they're going to misuse it, well, then we're all human beings. But they misuse it, they make hierarchies out of human beings. Some human beings are not, or less human than others. One other correction. The grading of priorities on the sin by the small children, I think that was ambiguous. Relation, because I think they were responding to their priority response, not to which they felt more sin.
Well, my point in making that observation is that we tend to teach word of wisdom things earlier and younger,
they were responding in relation to what they thought of first.
Well, but their thinking also comes from the teaching that they received from their parents.
There's a question back here in the back. Can we go on? Okay, let me go on. There's a question back here. The question was, he was asking for some description of gateway drug usage.
Gateway drug usage refers to just that. They are the drugs and the substances that children in that 12 to 14 year range elementary school begin to use that get them into the mainstream of drug and substance abuse. What we find, more than specific drugs, is that the media, and I mean, we're taught that every problem in the world can be solved in 30 minutes unless the TV show lasts 60 minutes. You know, we're taught plop, plop, fizz, fizz, you know, Papa Chocks, and from the time that kids are this big, they're taught to take something and ingest something to relieve their pain, to get rid of, they're not taught to, you know, if I have a headache, it should be gone right now, immediately. And more than specific drugs, it's a societal influence that tends to create that gateway mentality. But when they hit that stage of development where peers become more important, they have more access to substances. Substances become the thing that they take to get into it. Certainly cigarettes become one of the primary. Go look at any grocery store that you want to find, and you're going to find wine coolers sitting right next to Koala, which look identical in the bottles. I mean, it's just spiked Kool-Aid is all it is. And those are the kinds of gateway type things that lead to more addictive processes.
Okay, right over here.
Yes, I was wondering if the messages we hear in Relief Society or read in church magazines and things like that help foster codependency in our society. Will you talk about that?
I think I'd like to address that one, and the answer is clearly yes, particularly among women who are taught that their role is to support and help and serve, and very little is given to women on teaching them to affirm their identity, know their power, and therefore they really do quickly get caught into codependency.
Especially singles. I think it's especially bad, the messages they give to single people.
That they're not okay. Yes. Right here.
I was wondering, when I was a teenager, about 30 years ago or so, I don't remember any of my girlfriends having any eating disorders. and nowadays it's a very common problem. Is it more prevalent nowadays, or just that nobody knew about it in the old days?
This question was on the prevalence of eating disorders. Harold?
When I did my dissertation on bulimia, I needed 40 subjects for my study, and I was quite shocked and surprised that I had at least 10 subjects that were over the age of 50 years of age. In other words, matter of fact, many of them could not put a label on what they were doing until they seen my ad in the paper, and they recognized, you know, the binge eating, the purging, and many of them had been doing this for many years. However, I do also think that there's a societal influence. Matter of fact, Hildur Brook, who is one of the pioneers in treating eating disorders, notes that there was a dramatic increase in eating disorders after 1968, and that's when Twiggy came onto the scene. You know, that emaciated boy-like look. And that was 1968.
I'd like to respond to that one as well. When I was an undergraduate at BYU, and that was over 20 years ago, I remember the thing in my dorm was girls going out and eating hot fudge sundaes and then coming back and purging. We didn't have a label for it, but it definitely happened.
Historically, we only have to look back to the Civil War era to find evidence of especially bulimia. Scarlett O'Hara didn't keep a 16-inch waist, you know, she was anorexic, you know. Yeah, the vomitorium.
Okay, back here.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. Do you think wishes were on? Is that me?
You're right.
Do you think wishes were on drugs?
Okay, response on Bush's war on drugs.
No, I don't.
Response. Go ahead, in the middle.
Something that I hear more and more often, especially set middle class.
I have a cartoon on my desk. I have a cartoon on my desk that shows two obese ladies in the celestial kingdom saying that what I like about being here the most is I'm perfectly light.
Go ahead, right here.
One thing, I'm from Ohio, living in Texas, and one thing I've noticed is that any kind of Alcoholics Anonymous, or Narcotics Anonymous, or Overeaters Anonymous meet in churches, but I've never seen them meet in a Mormon church.
Nope, they don't.
That's correct.
I would expect that in Utah, but I've never seen it anywhere else. And that's a strong message that we're sending.
What is the message you think we're sending?
The comment was made over here just was a really good one, and that's that, you know, smoking and drinking coffee are almost part of the ritual of AA and 12-step kind of groups.
There are non-smoking AA.
Yeah, I know there are, but that's Utah hasn't found that out yet.
Okay. Right over here, you've been patient.
The benzodiazepines, the relaxants, Valium, Ativan, Atarax, Atapin, all of those mother's little helper type drugs, Xanax, yeah. Those become the highest abuse category.
What about Ritalin for kids? Is that above the national average?
In Utah?
Yes.
Yeah.
I heard that.
We have more kids here.
Okay, right here.
Yes, it is. Per capita, yeah, and per percentage.
Is it per child? I have a 23-year-old son who was diagnosed obsessive compulsive when he was 13.
Somebody messed up the diagnosis.
Question was on the treatment for obsessive compulsive behavior.
Well, first of all, obsessive compulsive disorder is not the same as obsessive compulsive process that we've been talking about. We've been talking about a process, a more real general and abstract term. Obsessive compulsive disorder is a real deeply ingrained disorder. It also has a biochemical component. So now they're finding a little bit of aid in treating obsessive compulsive disorder with antidepressants, tricyclic drugs, which help people control the obsessive thoughts and those urges to a point where the psychotherapy can begin to engage and help. And so the drugs isn't the panacea, but it does help them control it long enough so they can get some confidence that therapy will help them.
We have time for one more question over here.
Is hierarchical thinking and what the ICAT drive right along with it, the patriarchal order, really destructive of spirituality in support of merely adherence to a religious thought?
Elizabeth Dodson Gray says that is the basis of our conceptual trap, which she says is a little room we can't get out of. Ranking diversity, which had its basis in patriarchy, males, females, children, animals, and under there. Time's up. I'm sorry, I did say one more. Our time is up, and I'd like to thank you for your participation and for your questions. Thanks.